Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, and we're discussing George Fletcher's book, Our Secret Constitution. Bruce, glad to have you on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure being here.
Well, we're talking about Fletcher's book. It's certainly that's a place where we're jumping off here. I wonder if you could give the readers a 2 or 3 minute summary of what you take the most important points in that book to be.
Well, the fundamental point, and he's absolutely right about it, is that the Civil War profoundly transformed what it is to be an American, what our government's all about, and that this worship of the Founding Fathers, as if nothing important has happened since the 18th century, is simply dumb. So that's a fundamental thought which we often, especially in this curious era of so-called originalism, where everyone is trying to figure out what James Madison really thought about one thing or another, as if that's the be-all and end-all of Americanism, constitutional reflection, political ideas of Americans, that this is a big mistake, and that at the very least we should notice that Abe Lincoln existed, and that today for every person who knows who James Madison is walking around in the country, there are 2,000 who know what Abraham Lincoln did, or at least think they know. They might not really appreciate its significance. Fletcher's absolutely right in trying to jog us out of this infantile 18th century hero worship.
Okay, so to that extent, you would agree with him, I take it, that the Constitution was not written in 1789, that in some sense it has changed, and indeed changed profoundly.
Right. And how has it changed? Well, you know, basically, Fletcher does glimpse in this direction. We should look at the American Civil War and Abraham Lincoln as part of a world process, or maybe at least a European-wide process, not a world process, of liberal nationalism. What's going on in the United States in the 1860s is very similar to what's going on in France in the 1870s, the unification of Italy. All of these events are events in which there's a new sense of nationalism, equality, freedom, all bundled together, and a sense of a strong national identity and responsibility. And that's what we see, of course, in this rise of the Republican Party, the embrace of freedom as opposed to slavery, the willingness to fight the bloodiest war that occurred in the European sphere, at least, between the Napoleonic War and the First World War, and I mean the Civil War, and this tremendous hero of that emerges. For sure, the greatest politician statesman of our history, Abe Lincoln. So that's all great. I think, though, that George suffers a bit from hero worship here, and puts too much of this this great story of Reconstruction and renewal of American identity on Abe's shoulders, and too little on the American people's.
Could you elaborate on that? In what is it that the American people do, in your view, that George Fletcher misses in his book? And I know this expands on themes in your multi-volume work called We the People, for those who might be interested in pursuing those. So what is it that Fletcher is leaving out of his account of constitutional change that you think needs to be added?
Well, you know, Abe Lincoln is killed. right at the end of the Civil War, he's killed. He's very much like a Moses figure. What the meaning of the Civil War is and is not decided by Abe Lincoln at Gettysburg giving a little speech, or indeed his tortured reflections on slavery and evil. Just like in the Revolution in the 18th century, just like in the New Deal in the 20th century, there is this crisis, and as the crisis is resolving itself, or the real constitutional debate goes on, and that debate occurs in the United States between 1865 and 1868, in which the South, much to the embarrassment of the Northern Republicans who are in control of Congress, the South under the leadership of a Southern Unionist Loyalist president named Andrew Johnson, reconstructs itself. It says, look, we fought this war over the Union. You said we couldn't secede. You were right. Suddenly, the Northerners on Capitol Hill recognize that if these Southern states, which are happy to abolish slavery, but do not give blacks the power to vote, or don't give blacks the civil rights, meaning the right to sue and be sued, and things of that kind, but abolish slavery. Suddenly, the Northerners in Capitol Hill, who are controlling things, recognize that if these Southern states are allowed back into the Union, well then, the meaning of the Civil War is very, very modest. But they're placed in this tremendously embarrassing situation. They have been fighting a war for the Union, and the South says, Southern whites, that is, you won. Here we are back again, and suddenly the Thaddeus Stevens and many other so-called radical Republicans refuse to let the Southern whites back into Congress. This is a incredible act. You know, I mean, just imagine if the Republicans in Congress today, seeing the possibility of their imminent defeat, say that the East and West Coasts no longer can send representatives to Congress, and the blue states shall forever govern over the red states, or whatever color you like to color the political map. Well, that's just the kind of crisis that was precipitated by the Southerners, by the Northerners' decision to exclude the Southern states after the Civil War. And for 3 years, the Americans conducted this epic debate as to whether these white Southern Reconstructed states could return to the Union, and the a number of elections were fought and won by the Northern Republicans by large majorities, and in the end, these Southern white states were rejected. The South was reconstructed once again on principles of Negro suffrage and full rights, and the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed blacks and all American citizens fundamental rights, were enacted. It's that process which represents the a profound national commitment, first to national citizenship and second to equality, not speeches by Abraham Lincoln in at Gettysburg and other places during the war, that finally or at least fundamentally redefined through legal process the nature of American identity, citizenship, and commitment to equality. So while Fletcher brings a lot in this book into the foreground, which deserves to be put into the foreground, it is, for my taste, only the prelude to the a genuinely popular struggle and debate that swept the United States time and again, and is still remembered today, you know, by in the South, by sort of Southern Confederate sympathizers as the time when the Northern Yankees won and destroyed Southern white ascendancy, remembered today, most notably by Brown against Board of Education. It's that struggle about American identity which is really at the heart of things, and Fletcher doesn't emphasize it enough.
Is there a general way to describe this, the character of the change, the sort of fundamental radical change that you're talking about? I mean, in this particular case, it sounds as if the change was brought about primarily by the actions of Northern Republicans in Congress. Is that correct, or is another wider way of understanding what happened there and in general what happens when Sure. there is this kind of profound constitutional change?
Sure. The basic question that Andrew Johnson, who is the President of the United States, and all of these reconstructed states under his supervision claimed was this. This is a white man's country. We're going to free the slaves, but that shouldn't be understood to change that fact. This is a white man's country. We've had a disagreement among white men. You Northerners won that disagreement. But neither you in the North nor we in the South are willing to deny what has been the case in the first 80 years of American history. This is a white man's country. Now, people like Thaddeus Stevens, who had a mulatto wife, really, he never was married, but he and Sumner and the Republicans repudiated this idea that this is a white man's country. What he said was that you white people in the South were disloyal, and the people who were really loyal to the principles of the Union were the blacks. This is a country devoted to the loyal pursuit of freedom and equality and American citizenship, and every American who believes in freedom and equality is an American. And anybody who is a rebel, who doesn't believe in it, is, even though he has white skin, is not an American. Well, so it should be recalled that the Constitution of 1789 does not define who an American citizen is. That's why, of course, both the Southerners and the Northerners before the Civil War could think that, you know, when Robert E. Lee, for example, asked himself, he was a Union general, after all, he's a West Point graduate, should I go with the Union Army or should I go with the state of Virginia? The Constitution of 1787 didn't answer that question for him. The 14th Amendment, which is at the climax of this great struggle of whether this is a white man's country or not, a country based upon the rights of all American citizens, begins by defining American citizenship first and says anybody born in this country is an American citizen, and then he's a citizen of any state he lives in. And moreover, he has the rights of privilege. American government guarantees him privileges and immunities of citizenship. So this historic action was at the center of the debate. The states of the South were not permitted to re-enter the Union without first allowing blacks to vote and second accepting the fundamental transformation of American national identity implied by the idea that this is no longer a white man's country. It's a country in which everybody who is born here has these fundamental rights of American citizenship.
All right. I'd like to take a brief break for the benefit of anyone tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, and we're discussing George Fletcher's book, Our Secret Constitution. I'd like to see if I can get you to amplify on that a bit. And this really goes into the themes that you discuss in your multi-volume work, that the key for you in bringing about this change is something about the people, that it's, as the title of the multi-volume work suggests, that we the people plays an especially important role in bringing about fundamental constitutional change. How would you describe that process broadly, and what exactly do you mean by the power of the people to engage in higher lawmaking?
Sure. Well, every generation almost, there is a popular movement to redefine the foundations of American identity. That's, after all, what the American Revolution is about. Then we have Jackson. Then we have this Republican Party. The Republican Party is a movement party. Large numbers of people actually think that slavery is wrong, and finally convince enough Americans to get this constitutional program at the center of American politics. And we have the populists, another movement which fails in the 1890s to transform the foundations of American politics. Then we have the labor movement during the 1930s, which was a core ingredient of the transformation of the New Deal. Then we have the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And now we have the Republican Party is the movement party, a more conservative Republican mobilization is going on. So every generation, we have a movement that tries to redefine the foundations of American constitutionalism, sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing. The way we know when they succeed or fail is if they start winning a lot of elections while pushing their ideological agenda in an unembarrassed way. Well, this, of course, is a climactic, you know, perhaps the most dramatic example of this occurs between 1860 and 1876, where the Republican Party is increasingly radical in its commitments to a new understanding of the nation, not as composed of a master race, but as composed of all residents of the country committed to equality and freedom. And they keep on winning elections against the conservatives. The populists, climactically in 1896 with William Jennings Bryan, once again are trying to reorganize the polity, this time economically, against big capital, and they lose. Franklin Roosevelt helps transform the Democratic Party into a movement party and succeeds in reorganizing the foundations of American politics. So another complaint I have about George's book, for all its merits, is that he has actually misidentified the secret constitution. The idea that the Civil War Constitution is a secret is surprising, because after all, Brown against Board of Education, which is the greatest Supreme Court decision of the 20th century, is no secret. And it is based upon a profound understanding of the transformation that I was describing before that occurred after the Civil War. If we had to describe a constitution as a secret constitutional vote, it really isn't much of a secret either. It's the New Deal Constitution, which the present justices of the Supreme Court, by a succession of 5-4 votes, is nibbling away at, and with an obvious and eager intention to destroy. The secret constitution of the New Deal, if you like, is one which affirms national responsibility over the economy, national responsibility for the welfare of all Americans, not merely their rights, but their welfare, a competence of the national government to identify any and all problems of national concern and propose national solutions. Let's take the Endangered Species Act. Well, the present Supreme Court could well strike down the Endangered Species Act as unconstitutional because it's beyond the powers of commerce contemplated in 1789 to regulate commerce. And as a matter of initial understanding of 1789, it isn't very clear that the founders were great nature worshippers. They were intent on the project of killing as many trees as possible. But the constitutional foundations of environmental law in this country were not built in the 1780s and 90s, but they were built in the 1930s by the movement party, then the Democratic Party, affirming the general competence of Congress to define national problems nationally and then solve them nationally. And right now, one of our fundamental problems is environmental law, and that's environmental degradation. And that's why, thanks to the 1930s and the popular transformation then, that we take for granted the power to solve environmental problems nationally. But if the Supreme Court ignores the New Deal revolution and simply asks itself, well, what did the Civil War period that gave us the great national nationalizing amendments of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments thought about controlling the environment? What did Madison think about controlling the environment? Well, then suddenly the foundations of environmental law looked pretty shaky.
All right, let's focus in the last 5 minutes on this idea that there might be a fifth major change in the making. I take it that politically, at least, you have misgivings about those changes, but I also take it, given your work, that the misgivings are going to have to be different than saying this is what the Founding Fathers thought, this is what the Republicans thought in 1870, or even this is what the Democrats thought in 1935.
Completely right. Newt Gingrich, when he announced the contract with America, he was talking a language which American revolutionaries of every generation talked. The word social contract resonates to the beginning of this country and to the thought of John Locke. And when Newt Gingrich and the Radical Republican Party won a massive landslide victory of 1994, well, this was a very significant event. And if Newt Gingrich had followed up in 1996, let's say, or 2000, running for president and winning in a landslide, while the Republicans increased the size of their majority, in the year 2001, we would be looking at a phenomenon that resembled Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats in 1934, where on the left this time, we would see a popular movement winning election after election behind a clear, salient ideological program. Of course, that didn't happen, or it hasn't happened yet. Rather than 1994 being the signaling event in my vocabulary, it's just a signaling event indicating the rise of a new movement and a new agenda. And rather than following through on that in 1996, the Republican Party was too risky for them to appoint to nominate someone like Newt Gingrich. They took a normal politician like Bob Dole, who then loses big time. And rather than running in 2000 a candid campaign of a revolutionary kind, they get behind George Bush, who pretends that he's a moderate, like his father was. Of course, he doesn't even win the election in a decisive way. He is one of the quite remarkable things about our present moment in American history is that President Bush is governing as if he were Newt Gingrich, as if he had won a mandate, broad profound, mobilized from the people of the United States for a radical new program, both internationally and domestically. The only problem is that he hasn't. I have lots of aims. One aim is to be a relatively impartial and dispassionate observer of the dynamics of constitutional change in America. I try not to let my politics, my particular politics, get in the way of this. The fundamental pattern of American constitutional development is a relative constant over two centuries. It's a pattern of revolutionary transformation, oftentimes without violence, sometimes with violence, as in the Civil War, led by visionary leaders. And you may not like Newt Gingrich, but he is characteristically and qualitatively like that, as opposed to Bill Clinton, who is a characteristic politician of the status quo. The only basic problem is that this kind of ideological politics is going on in Washington, D.C. without the necessary popular support. We, the people, have not endorsed a radical transformative politics, and yet that's what we're getting, in part, of course, thanks to the vote of Osama bin Laden. That would be pretty funny, ironic, that Osama bin Laden casts the decisive vote for a fundamental change in American politics. We are in the middle of a constitutional transformation, but the jury's out whether it's going to be one like the populists who failed to transform the system in the 1890s, or like the New Deal or the 1960s civil rights movement, which succeeded in profoundly transforming the premises of American politics.
Well, I hate to say it, we're out of time. Very glad to have you in the show today.
Well, it's a big pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Bruce Ackerman, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. This is Hugh LaFollette, Fridays and Issues. Good day.